This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of July 29th, 2024. With Vice President Harris gaining traction as her party's likely presidential nominee, Democrats are making efforts to win an important voting bloc in the swing state of Arizona. Nearly 25% of Arizona voters in 2020 were Latino, a trend that is expected to continue in this year's presidential election. From the Politics Desk, Wayne Shetsky reports on how Harris is mobilizing Latino leaders to reach those voters.
Okay, let's do it all together. C-7.
94-year-old civil rights leader Dolores Huerta spoke in a sweltering union hall in Phoenix. She called on working-class voters, including those in the Latino community, to support the vice president.
We have to go recruit our compadres, our comadres, our vecinos, our neighbors, our relatives, okay?
Huerta was joined by Harris's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, the granddaughter of labor organizer Cesar Chavez.
I've seen who she's fighting for. When she's in the halls of power, she fights for families like ours.
Harris supporters say her campaign to reach Latino voters is an extension of the same efforts made by President Biden when he was running for re-election. But an ABC Washington Post Ipsos poll conducted before Biden stepped down from his re-election effort showed him with less support among Latinos than when he first took office. 49% of Latino voters supported him nationwide. That was still ahead of Trump, but down 10 percentage points from 2020. As a first-generation American, daughter of immigrants, and a woman of color, Harris has an opportunity to engage those voters in a way Biden could not, says Luis Acosta Herrera, an Arizona Democratic consultant.
I do think that there is a reinvigorating of that base and of people who maybe just didn't feel like Biden really represented them or felt like he just couldn't do it.
The Harris campaign says they've recruited nearly 2,000 new volunteers in Arizona since Biden dropped out. Backers believe Harris's vocal support for reproductive rights will also mobilize voters in the state. She's already visited Arizona twice this year to talk about abortion access. A 2022 poll from Pew showed 57% of Latinos across the country said abortion should be legal in most or all cases.
Once you get the comadre circuit going, there's no stopping it.
Tanya Torres runs a Phoenix public relations firm that specializes in community outreach and voter engagement. She says Harris's support for reproductive rights could ingratiate her with Latinas, and that Latina matriarchs like her can influence other voters and their families. And Torres says Harris's age, she's two decades younger than Joe Biden, is a big part of engaging younger Arizonans.
You have to remember that Latinos in Arizona are young. Their median age is about 29 years old. That's about 10 years younger than the overall Arizona population.
Critics, meanwhile, believe Harris is vulnerable on another issue important to Latino voters, immigration and the border. Republicans have already released an attack ad calling Harris Biden's border czar after the president put her in charge of efforts to slow migration in 2021. Joe Garcia with Chicanos por la Casa, a Latino nonprofit that provides social services in five states, says the immigration issue hits home for many Latino voters. He spoke with Harris earlier this year when she visited Phoenix. He warned her against thinking the 2.3 million Latinos in Arizona all share the same views about the border.
I advised her not to fall into the trap of focusing only on the border. The border crisis was there before she came. The border crisis will be there after she comes. Because the truth is, the border crisis is there because we've never done anything to fix it.
But the Biden administration's handling of immigration has been criticized by both parties in the state. Even Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs said Biden needed to do more to secure the border. But that didn't stop her from endorsing Biden and later Harris in this year's election. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. Energy Fuels has faced opposition for mining uranium near the Grand Canyon, with plans to transport that ore through the Navajo Nation. The first trucks launched Tuesday morning, but as Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the company is being accused of breaking a promise to notify stakeholders 2 weeks in advance.
Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin took to social media to notify the public that hauling had unexpectedly begun. He ordered the Navajo police to find the two trucks and turn them around, but they were unsuccessful. The Navajo Nation, Havasupai Tribe, Coconino County, and U.S. Forest Service say they weren't notified until Tuesday morning, and Nygren shared that he even had a meeting scheduled with Energy Fuels later this week.
My EPA director got a voicemail from the executive on Energy Fuels, told me that they're wondering if they can still meet with the Navajo Nation on Saturday. And I said, nope, cancel that meeting. Not after today. We'll see you guys in court.
In a statement late Tuesday, Energy Fuels says the company never promised to provide 2 weeks' notice. Gabriel Piatarazzo, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. You can test your state smarts with our new A to Z quiz. There are two quizzes each week starting on Tuesdays and Fridays. And bonus, you can grab the new KJZZ Play sticker at play.kjzz.org. In business news, labor rights leader Cesar Chavez's Workers Fast of 1972 drew national attention, bringing prominent political figures from all over the country to Phoenix. Chavez chose Santa Rita Hall, just south of downtown Phoenix, as the place of his water-only fast in an act of nonviolent protest. Keller Brown has this update to the historic Phoenix building.
The location of the Workers Fast was important to Chavez.
And being centrally located, I think Cesar was happy with that and decided that would be his place, a fast.
That was Jose Cortez, a former organizer and bodyguard of Cesar Chavez. Cortez says he and another man helped save Santa Rita Hall in 2000 when they saw the condition the building was in.
I mean, the weeds were waist high. There was piles of junk and debris piled in front. And I said, God, this is horrible. This is the building where history was made. This is where Cesar fasted.
The other man that helped clean up the building was Jose Abre, who goes by Casper, a board member at Chicanos por la Causa, a nonprofit organization advocating for underserved individuals and communities. Cortez and Casper wanted to preserve the building and educate the community on how important it is.
Why don't we get the board to move on this and buy Santa Rita?
Cortez and Casper brought the state of the building to CPLC's attention, particularly then-President Pete Garcia.
You know, he listened to us. He liked our idea. He went to the board and moved on it. The board decided that they would make an offer, and they bought Santa Rita.
Chicanos por la Causa has had ownership of the building ever since. In 2022, then-president and CEO of CPLC David Adame committed to set aside money to help recover the building. Adame resigned in October of 2023. Fast forward to 2024, the construction and rehab of the building has officially gotten underway. Nick Smith, Vice President of Real Estate Development for CPLC.
We hope to be completed with the building by the end of the year.
Smith says they have major plans to bring the building back to life.
So everything from the infrastructure of the building all the way to the roof, as well as windows, power, water, sewer.
To kick off the renovation, Smith says the makeover is currently being funded by private dollars as part of the first phase. The second phase will include federal dollars as part of the cultural corridor and the land reuse strategy from the City of Phoenix Aviation Department.
We see this building as being just the beginning of a much bigger plan. At that time, it's really where the federal dollars make the most sense to come in and sort of help out when it comes to the context of the building.
Part of the bigger plan includes other buildings in the area of Santa Rita Hall. While CPLC is not in charge of everything outside of Santa Rita Hall, the cultural corridor is in place to reconnect buildings like this one to others in the area. Jordan Feld, the Deputy Aviation Director with Sky Harbor, is helping people understand what exactly the land reuse strategy will do to the neighborhoods west of the airport.
These legacies in our history exist in this area, and so the cultural corridor would tell that story.
The neighborhoods include El Campito, Cuatro Milpas, Ann Ott, Green Valley, and San Juan Batista.
It would also provide enhanced mobility, better, you know, safety, so, you know, enhanced street lighting, better crosswalks, things like that.
Feld says they have a $10 million grant specifically for the cultural corridor to aid in improving all kinds of things in the area. Feld acknowledges that people in the area want to see progress, but the timeline of the grant is stretched out over many years, expiring in 2033.
I don't mind the 2033 because if not for environmental analysis and community outreach, yeah, we could probably start the construction within 2 years, but that wouldn't necessarily lead to the best outcome, right?
Feld says they plan on exhausting the funds and being done with the project before then. For the remainder of 2024, Feld and the Aviation Department plan to identify more priority parcels that they want to bring to City Council. Keller Brown, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news, in a world with next-day delivery, mass consumption, and lost packages, there is a lot of merchandise at risk of going to waste. But as Bridget Dowd tells us, a program at Grand Canyon University works to redirect those extra goods to families in need.
That's the sound of Patty Guzman rolling a cart down the aisles of an 88,000-square-foot warehouse off West Coulter Street and North 27th Avenue in Phoenix.
So just browsing around to see what basically catches my eye.
She's scanning shelves full of donated merchandise, but she's not looking for herself. She works for Catholic Charities, which helps people who live on tax credit properties. Those are housing projects owned by developers or landlords who participate in the federal low-income housing tax credit program.
I found socks last time I was here, so I'm planning to do a back-to-school, oh, see, there's more here, a back-to-school event for the kids.
The warehouse is owned by Grand Canyon University. Its program CityServe works with charities like Guzman's to deliver excess goods to low-income communities. Usually each organization requests specific items and schedules a pickup time, but they can also look through self-select items for things they might not think to ask for.
Like these calendars I just found, residents can use them to write down their appointment times. There are, stuff that they have going on.
Nathan Cooper oversees GCU CityServe.
We started this in partnership with an organization called CityServe International. It's based out of Bakersfield, California. And what they do is they partner with organizations across the United States in each state.
He says they get donations of returned, overstocked, and discontinued items from retailers like Amazon and Walmart.
So, like an organization would donate 10 pallets to us of Tupperware. And the reason they donated it to us was because right after Christmas, they were sitting on it and it had Christmas packaging. So there's nothing actually Christmas about the Tupperware itself. It was just that the packaging had like reindeer, whatever it was, on it.
A lot of times they don't know what they're getting until they open the back of a truck. Then just a few staff members and thousands of student volunteers help sort the items into categories.
So indoor items, that could be anything from bath mats to shower caddies to TV mounts to fake plants to throw pillows. So think anything that you put in your house to make it feel like a home, I like to say.
Other categories include hygiene products, medical equipment, kitchen items and small appliances, toys, baby items, and the list goes on.
Then our partners, we have about 150 partners across the state. They're able to send in a wish list each week, and we call it a wish list, but it's a list of items that they have identified that are needed in their community.
CityServe volunteers then pack pallets specific to those needs for organizations to pick up from the warehouse.
That means they don't have to have a storage space, and they can actually pick it up from our doorstep and bring it right to the family's doorstep.
About 30 to 40 organizations stop by for pallets in any given week, and they come from all over the state.
We have organizations that come from like Havasu or Tucson, so it's a little further of a trip. So they only usually come like once a month or once every other month. But then we have organizations that are right down the road from us that will come every week.
Guzman is one of those people. She picks up donations every Wednesday.
A resident of mine needed a walker, and he's been asking me for a walker for so long, and we're able to get it, sometimes we're not, and I was able to find one here, and when I gave it to him, his face lit up, and he was really excited to get a walker, so it just, it just brings me a lot of happiness.
GCU's president, Brian Mueller, says CityServe has grown a lot in just under 3 years and is still expanding. He says organizations that are not contracted with CityServe are interested in partnering.
They want to become part of it because they've got goods that they can't resell into the marketplace.
Volunteers have cleaned out closed office buildings to collect donated furniture. They've also hosted on-site events like drives for families to pick up boxes of food and hygiene products. Mueller says an organization that builds beds and is based out of Idaho reached out.
They came down and they showed up at 6 in the morning. They set up an assembly line. I got 150 students to volunteer, and they got placed on the assembly line, and we built 80 bunk beds in a 3.5-hour period of time and got them into the homes where kids were sleeping on the floor.
Cooper says while there are a lot of people hurting in the world today, there are also a lot of people who want to help.
We live in such a world of excess, I feel, that it's not a lack of resources, but a lack of logistics and relationships, and that's really what we're trying to build here.
In the time CityServe has been a part of GCU, the program has distributed more than $12 million worth of goods to about 50,000 families. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now from KJZZ's The Show, how the gathering habits of a squirrel unique to Arizona could be the key to saving it. Here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
New research sheds some light on how these squirrels hoard their food. They don't call it squirreling away for nothing. The Mount Graham red squirrel has experienced disturbances over the past several years, including from fires and insect outbreaks. Over the last three decades, their populations have declined significantly. Our next guest says as of December 2023, there were 144 of them. Sean Mahoney is a research scientist in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona and is also affiliated with the Mount Graham biology programs. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked what he was trying to figure out with this research.
Yeah, so finding food is probably the most important thing that an animal needs to do. And finding food can be quite a challenge for an animal. And it can be especially challenging during periods of scarcity, like during the winter when food is just highly limited. And so some animals have just said, okay, I'm not going to deal so much with trying to find food in the winter. And they just decide to hibernate. But there are a lot of animals that don't hibernate. And so they need to still find food during periods of scarcity, like during the winter. And there are three main ways that animals will do this. They'll hoard food. And one strategy of hoarding food is referred to as larder hoarding. And this is when an animal takes a whole lot of food and stores it at a central location. And then they can return to that central location in the winter and access food. And then animals will also scatter hoard food. And this is when animals take smaller amounts of food and hide them across larger areas. And then animals also will do what we've referred to as mixed hoarding. And this is when they'll larder hoard food, but also scatter hoard food. And an example of this are red squirrels in eastern Arizona and on Mount Graham. And so hoarding food is really important for how animals survive through the winter, when food is really limited on the landscape. And so it can be a really important behavior to understand, especially in a conservation context, because it allows us to understand how animals can survive during these periods of scarcity, like during the winter.
And it seems as though you found that, at least for some of them, like there's some amount of flexibility with this, like it's not a system that is set in stone.
Yeah, so what we did in our study was we were primarily interested in understanding this behavior in red squirrels because they exhibit this mixed strategy, and it can offer insights into their conservation planning. We also wanted to understand this behavior in a broader context for mammals more broadly. And when we looked at the evolution of the behavior more broadly within mammals, we found three main patterns emerge from that analysis. And what we found was that the hoarding behavior was related to something about the climate. So if a species was living in colder climates, they were more likely to larder hoard their food rather than scatter hoard their food. So it seems to be related to precipitation and temperature. And then a third factor that emerged from that analysis was population density. And mammals that were living at higher population densities, so if there were just more individuals of the same species in the area, they were more likely to larder hoard their food. And so given that we found that at this broad analysis of other mammals, we wanted to explicitly test that within Mount Graham red squirrels. And to do that, we used a quarter century data set of Mount Graham red squirrel data. So we had their population density and the number of cones that they stored in their middens for about 25 years. And what we found was that in years when the population density was really high, Mount Graham red squirrels would store more cones in their midden. And this supports the hypothesis that they're experiencing more competition at these higher population densities. And that means the squirrels need to invest more. They need to put more food in their midden and then rigorously defend it from competitors that might try to steal the food from them so that they can survive the winter. But then interestingly, we did not find that temperature and precipitation was related to the number of cones that they would store in the midden.
So what does all of this tell you about the efforts to conserve and preserve the species of squirrel?
So this finding, it's an interesting finding in that at these higher population densities, squirrels tend to put more cones into their midden. And at these lower population densities, which they're living at now, they're living at lower population densities, they're not putting as much food into their midden. And this sort of suggests that they might be shifting to another behavior because they still need to access food during these periods of scarcity, like in the winter. And anecdotally, what we have noticed is that the red squirrels, they still maintain that main midden, but they also have started to develop these kind of smaller middens, which we refer to as satellite middens, around that main larder. And although this isn't full-on scatter hoarding necessarily, it does sort of suggest that it's kind of this modified scatter hoarding behavior. And what this means is that right now, the critical habitat designation for this endangered subspecies is written to protect habitat under the assumption that squirrels are building this central midden. But if they start to shift towards scatter hoarding, then we may need to tweak the critical habitat designations to more better accommodate the habitat needs of the red squirrel.
How big of a shift would that be?
That would be quite a legal challenge that would involve changing the critical habitat designation that's written by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So it would be quite a challenge to do. And I'm not suggesting that that needs to happen now. Mainly what I'm suggesting is that it's important to continue the monitoring of the foraging behavior of the red squirrel, just to keep track of how their food storage behavior might be shifting in response to these population density changes that we're seeing.
All right. That is Sean Mahoney, a research scientist at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment. Sean, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
In health news. The Olympics are nearly half over, but later this month, another set of athletes will compete at the Parisian venues at the Paralympics. As Jill Ryan reports, for wheelchair users specifically, the opportunity to play sports not only opens the door for gold, it also boosts the chance for employment, but many barriers are in the way.
Three-time former Paralympian Renee Tyree was not always a wheelchair user. She was paralyzed in the 1980s at 19 after an illness. Her previous sports participation ended, and she moved from Wisconsin to attend the University of Arizona to pursue a new life.
When I became a chair user, I hadn't really initially thought about sports, but was exposed to it.
U of A's adaptive athletics program was smaller back then, and Tyree to this day credits it and sports for helping with her career success.
The position that I have now is with Encompass Health. I'm a regional director of pharmacy, and I oversee the operations for 18 hospitals with regard to pharmacy.
For context, the National Spinal Cord Injury Statistical Center says immediately after an injury, employment drops from 65% to 18%. That figure never recovers. At best, it improves to just under the halfway point some decades later. As for what sports has to do with careers, according to a 2015 study, which is the latest on the correlation, depending on how long a wheelchair user participates in adaptive sports, they could see about a 40% increase in employment likelihood. And Tyree is not surprised. Much of her sports career was wheelchair basketball.
You're getting stronger. You're more confident in your body and mechanics, your mental abilities, strategies. All of these things are you know, built and developed, and you gain these skills that definitely correlate and translate and confidence into a career and being able to, you know, advocate for yourself.
Michael Cottingham is one of the researchers from the 2015 study. He says one of the other factors for low employment are structural barriers that risk some wheelchair users losing their health care benefits.
If you get employed enough that you do no longer qualify for public service, like for Medicare, Medicaid, but you are not at the point where you are getting insurance through your employer, because maybe you're hourly employed, or maybe you just aren't given that benefit, or it's just cost prohibitive for you. You really can't justify going back to work full time.
But adaptive sports has increasingly become a pathway to a degree. Dustin Stauber competes on U of A's wheelchair racing team. Back in May at a competition, he talked about the impact of scholarships.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. College is really expensive, and a lot of us have like huge like medical bills, or even a chair like this just costs a whole lot of money. So it's like a big lift in financially. Like it helps financially to help like offset the costs of just having a disability, and it's amazing. Like we wouldn't be here without the scholarships.
He's on scholarship at U of A, which is one of 23 colleges offering adaptive sports programs in the country. But there's another barrier. Adaptive sports equipment is expensive and, for the most part, not covered by insurance. The San Diego Foundation says it's considered to be a luxury item. That's where the Challenged Athletes Foundation comes into play. Here's co-founder Bob Babbitt.
The equipment we were buying back in the day was, you know, $3,000, $5,000 pieces of equipment. A power soccer chair is $10,000.
Over 30 years, CAF has raised more than $178 million to provide grants to eligible athletes, professional or otherwise, to help pay for equipment.
Don't ever underestimate the power of sport. Sport, when you have an accident of some sort, it can help you avoid that spiraling depression by having a new goal. You might be a different person now because of what you went through, but being a different person and finding a different sport doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, because all of a sudden you were never considered an Olympic athlete, and a lot of our athletes go on to win multiple gold medals at the Paralympics.
Jill Ryan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in Fronteras News. The union representing asylum officers is backing a federal suit against the Biden administration for its asylum restrictions at the border. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, Elisa Resnick has more.
The National Citizenship Services Council 119, the union that represents roughly 1,500 asylum and refugee officers, filed a brief supporting that suit this week. It says the immigration system was once carefully calibrated to avoid returning people with genuine asylum claims back to persecution. But this policy will almost certainly remove many people who would otherwise qualify and strip them of the opportunity to raise their claims. The union argues the rules blanket ineligibility to asylum seekers at the border is both ineffective and illegal, and says officers are unable to perform their jobs as a result. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. It's made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ, your news and information station.